Welcome back to Open Line at WSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, a journalist who grew up in a secular home where he says spirituality was almost a taboo subject, he embarks on a year-long attempt to obey the dictates of the Bible literally. A.J. Jacobs said he didn't want to pick and choose which biblical rules he followed, as he suspects some people do. He wants to be sure that he avoided, for example, wearing clothes made of mixed fibers, that he did not touch a woman, including his wife Julie, at that time of the month when biblical injunctions say that a woman is unclean. But also he sought to follow the injunction to daily prayer. He says that was unfamiliar territory for him. And to obey the commandment, he says he breaks every day, thou shalt not covet. We'll find out more about this year-long spiritual odyssey. A.J. Jacobs is an editor at Esquire magazine. His New York Times bestseller is now in paperback. It's entitled The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. And my guest is speaking here in Columbus tonight in a Thurber House Evenings with Authors event. Welcome to Open Light, A.J. Jacobs. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me, Fred.
And so we're at 614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you'd like to join the show. And you can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Well, A.J., you say your spiritual matters were not an object of conversation generally in your household. Huh?
Oh, no. It was an extremely secular home. As I say in the book, I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian, so not very. But I became increasingly interested in religion over the years. I had a young son. I wanted to know what to teach him, so I decided one way to learn about religion was to just dive in head first. Mm-hmm. I like to learn about things from the inside out.
Well, you really went at it because you got yourself an advisory board of spiritual advisors for this year-long quest.
It's true. I had rabbis, priests, ministers, agnostics, anyone who I could get my hands on. And I'm glad I had that because it's an incredibly complicated book, the Bible, and so I needed as much guidance as I could get.
One of the first things you did, you sat down, you read it, the Bible, from cover to cover. Is that right?
That's right. I read it. I never read it before. And I read – there are an estimated 3,000 versions of the Bible. So I didn't read all 3,000 versions, but I read as many different versions as I could, the Christian versions, Jewish versions. A friend of mine sent me something called the Hip-Hop Bible, which where the 23rd Psalm is rendered as, "The Lord is all that," as opposed to the more traditional, "The Lord is my shepherd." So I wanted to get as broad a sampling as possible.
And you took notes.
Oh, yes. I absolutely took notes. I actually took notes of every piece of wisdom, every rule, every nugget of advice that I could find. And I compiled this list of rules, and it turned out to be quite a long list, over 700 rules. And that is what I wanted to live for the year. I wanted to follow every one of those.
700 rules. By the way, you went to a Bible store, right, in New York when you were looking for different kinds of Bibles, and they even told you about a Bible that you could read on the subway so that nobody would know you're reading the Bible.
That is true. There's several versions. There's one which looks like a teenage girls' magazine. It almost looks like Seventeen magazine. It's laid out. It's got a woman on the cover and sidebars about what the Bible says about dating. So it is fascinating to see how the Bible is marketed to different groups of people.
But I guess at one point on the subway reading the Bible, you did find that you got some from secular people some funny looks, huh?
Well, it's true. I mean, it was interesting the whole year, the reaction that people had, because by the end, I looked quite biblical. I had this huge beard because the Bible says you cannot shave the corners of your beard. I didn't know where the corners were, so I just let the whole thing grow.
How long did it get to be?
Oh, it was down to about my solar plexus, I'd say, almost.
Wow.
And it was, it was huge, unruly. I got called everything from Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, to ZZ Top.
And people would shout at you on the streets. Is that right, as you walk by?
That's right. I mean, New York is a city where you see some strange-looking people. But even a guy, you know, even in New York, someone with a huge beard and white robes and sandals and a walking stick, that does stand out.
Well, there's a cover on the Year of Living Biblically. There's a picture of you and your white robe. Why did you choose a white robe and a walking stick? What was that? Was that a biblical injunction or was that simply?
Well, towards the end of the year, I really wanted to get into character as much as possible to try to literally get – I wanted to get in the mindset and the literal sandals of our forefathers. So I actually started to dress like that. I will say the white – wearing white is a biblical rule. There's in Ecclesiastes, one of my favorite books of the Bible, it says that you should always wear white garments. Uh-huh. And I decided to take that literally and wore white garments. And I have to say it was quite lovely. I felt much more spiritual and pure wearing white garments. And I felt in a better mood. I looked at myself, like, how could I be in a bad mood if I look like I'm about to play the semifinals at Wimbledon?
Well, so AJ, you sought to obey these injunctions about dress, for example, but also behavioral injunctions, right?
Oh, yeah. It changed every aspect of my life, the way I talked, the way I ate, the way I thought, the way I touched my wife, the way I walked. So I wanted to obey everything without picking and choosing to see how it affected my life, what made my life better and what was maybe not relevant. So I wanted to follow the famous ones, the Ten Commandments, love your neighbor, be fruitful and multiply. And I was, by the way, I was fruitful and multiplied. I had twin boys during the year.
Very, very fruitful and quite multipliable.
Thank you. I take my project seriously. But I also wanted to follow the ones that are often ignored, the dozens or hundreds of Old Testament laws that are often overlooked. The beard was one. There's a law in the Old Testament that says you cannot wear clothes made of mixed fibers. It sounded strange and absurd on the face of it, but I decided I'll never know if it has any meaning for me unless I try it. So I did. I got rid of all of my poly cotton T-shirts. And there's another for instance, in the Old Testament, there's some difficult rules to follow. In 21st century America, it says that you should stone adulterers. But I felt I had to at least try that. So
I want to save that one because that's a great story. But I wanted to backtrack a little. You had a board of spiritual advisors of many different faiths. And did anybody tell you, don't do this? Or did they all say, hey, this is a really great idea. We think you ought to try it. Eh?
Well, it was interesting. I expected more skepticism. But I think people sensed that I was going in there with deep curiosity and an open mind. I wasn't going in necessarily to mock religion. I was more trying to understand it. I was trying to understand the allure. Was I missing anything by not having any religion in my life? What did the Bible mean? And what is the correct interpretation of the Bible? So I think they sensed my earnestness. You know, I hope the book is entertaining and I hope that it's funny, but I also went in with a deeply serious goal, which was to try to understand religion and the Bible.
One of your spiritual advisors said to you, you know, don't think that this won't change you. He said, this is very powerful stuff that you're doing. You know, you're an agnostic and a secular person now, but don't think that this year might not change you.
Yeah. And he was right. I mean, it changed me in 100 ways, large and small, far greater than I expected. And everything from I think I'm much more grateful than I was. The gratitude was one of the huge themes of the year because I was saying all these prayers of thanksgiving. So, and I almost got carried away. I would say we would be thankful for everything. I would press the elevator button and be thankful that the elevator arrived and step into the elevator, be thankful the elevator did not plummet to the basement. So I was thankful for hundreds of things every day. And it's a strange way to live, but also kind of great because you start to realize there are hundreds of things every day that go right. So try to focus on those as opposed to the three or four that go wrong.
So you're a more grateful person. Now.
I'm a more grateful person. Yeah. It changed my spirituality. I don't want to ruin the ending.
We can save that if you'd like.
Well, that's all right. Well, I'll tell you, okay. I didn't become a monk, or mm-hmm. I didn't become a Hasidic Jew. But it did change my spirituality. I started the year as an agnostic, and throughout the year, I went through all sorts of phases, including believing in God. But by the end of the year, I became what a minister friend. He's a Lutheran minister, and he came up with a great phrase that I love. He says that I'm a reverent agnostic, which sounds paradoxical, but I love it because whether or not there's a God, I believe in the idea of sacredness and how certain things can be sacred. The Sabbath can be sacred. I learned to really love the Sabbath, this sanctuary in time. Prayer can be sacred, or our family time can be sacred, and that there is an importance to sacredness mm-hmm. in our lives.
What does that mean to you, sacred?
Sacred means, the actual origin of the word is other, to separate, to put it apart. So I think that it's important that you have the mundane world, but then you have this other. For instance, the Sabbath. I was a workaholic before this, and with the BlackBerry knows no bounds. The BlackBerry is weekday, weekend. It's a slave driver. So to have this one day a week where you specifically say to yourself, I am not going to work. I'm going to appreciate what I have, what God or the universe has given me. I'm going to spend time with my family. You have to make a conscious effort to embrace and be thankful for what we have, and that I find sacred.
Do you keep the Sabbath in a certain way now?
I do try to keep the Sabbath.
How do you do that? What do you refrain from work, obviously.
I refrain from work. I don't keep it in the way that the Orthodox Jews keep it, in that there are many rules that Orthodox Jews follow. You're not allowed to turn on or off lights, things of that nature. I more keep it in that I don't work. I consciously spend time with the family. I try not to look at email, mm-hmm. answer the phone. This is a day. And I actually think that the Sabbath is a great thing, whatever your beliefs are. If you're an atheist, an agnostic, or religious, the Sabbath is a great thing. I'm very pro-Sabbath.
Because we've got this 24-hour work culture now. And even whether you think of the Sabbath as Saturday or Sunday or whenever you think of it, even then, you see people going home and doing construction projects outside their houses, so that saws are going all day and lawnmowers. So, the whole neighborhood is just a buzz, so people are working all the time.
I agree, yeah. And it's I think that humans need to recharge their batteries. They need a downtime, and we've gotten in society to this place where we have no downtime, and I think that's bad. We're missing something.
My guest, A.J. Jacobs, is an editor for Esquire magazine. His New York Times bestseller is now in paperback. It's called The Year of Living Biblically. It's subtitled One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. And A.J., you're here in Columbus, and you're going for the Thurber House Evenings with Authors, and you'll be talking and reading from the book, I imagine, and having conversation. Tonight at 7:30 at the Columbus Performing Arts Center at 549 Franklin Avenue for Thurber House. The Columbus Performing Arts Center, 549 Franklin Avenue. You can get tickets at the door, and if you'd like ticket information, call Thurber House, 464-1032. That's 464-1032. So A.J. Jacobs in town tonight. We're at 614-292-8513 for your questions and comments. Also, you can email a question or a comment, a brief one, to openline@wosu.org. Tell me, what are some of the injunctions in terms of the Sabbath that you actually did follow at a certain point?
Well, the Sabbath in the Bible, it says certainly no work. It also says no picking up sticks, so I made sure not to do that. At points in the Bible, it seems to indicate that you should not talk during the Sabbath. So I tried that for a couple of weekends. That didn't go over well with my wife, who, we have three kids, so we kind of need to communicate. On the whole, the project was an interesting it was a mixed bag for my wife. My wife is a saint for putting up with me on this one, so I thank her.
So she advanced spiritually as well during this year.
Well,
you had
that's right. She is. Maybe it was always in her. But there were parts of it that she did love. She loved that I became more grateful and more appreciative of certain aspects of religion. She loved, I think, the Sabbath, at least the times when I was talking. But then there were parts of it that drove her absolutely crazy. I had to build a biblical hut, and I couldn't get permission. I live in New York City, and I couldn't get permission to build it on the sidewalks of New York, so I built it in our living room. She did not like the construction project in our living room.
The hut was made out of?
It was wood and canvas. And,
where's the biblical injunction to do that? Where did you find that?
Well, that is once a year in the Old Testament. It says that we should build a hut and live in it for 7 days to remember our forefathers. And this is actually still practiced by many Jews. It's called Sukkot. And I found it to be very interesting because it was almost like the Bible is telling you to experiment with this other way of life so you can feel how our forefathers lived. Mm-hmm. And so it was almost parallel to my year where I was trying to live like our forefathers. So it was almost like God is saying to everyone, try it. Try this is, you know, see how our forefathers lived so you can experience it and see how difficult it was and appreciate what they went through for us.
Did you find yourself appreciating what they went through? It was a serious purpose to this.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, mine, as I said, was in my living room, so there was not, I didn't have to get the wind and the dust and the plagues. I was able to avoid those. So I kind of got the easy way out, but I still learned to appreciate.
Well, now, your wife, Julie, I bet she didn't appreciate the part of the Bible that says you shouldn't touch a woman around her time of month or for a week after her period or so. How did you handle that?
Oh, yes. That was probably one of her least favorite injunctions. And if you take the Bible really literally and strictly, it also says that you cannot sit on a seat where a woman in her time of month has sat, because the seat becomes impure. And my wife found this incredibly offensive. So she decided to sit in every seat in our apartment, every chair, while she was in her time. And I was forced to stand for much of the year.
But then you bought something called a handy seat.
That's true. Handy seat? That was sort of my ad hoc solution. It's a portable chair, so I would not let anyone else sit on it. So it remained pure. And I would take it on wherever I went, to a restaurant, on the subway, on the bus. And that is that's sort of how I made it through.
Did your wife ever say to you at some point, are you nuts?
Oh, pretty much every day. Yeah. she's put up with quite a bit because this is not my first experiment in living. It's sort of the way I like to approach topics. So before the book on the year of living biblically, I wrote a book called The Know-It-All, where I read the Encyclopedia Britannica from A to Z and tried to learn everything I could about human history and the world around us. And that one was also a bit trying for her because I was so enthusiastic about what I was learning that I would bring up facts at every juncture. And after a while, she started to fine me $1 for every irrelevant fact that I inserted into conversation.
It could be a bit annoying after a while.
Yeah, it's sort of Cliff Clavin-ish.
Yeah. You were saying she hoped that instead of doing the year of living biblically, your project would have been like a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt.
Right. She was. She said, do we have to go through this again? But she put up with it. I mean, it's better than there was another project. I work for Esquire magazine, mm-hmm. and I've written a few articles, which are also these sort of human guinea pig life experiments. And one of them was about a movement called Radical Honesty. And this is a movement that says you should never, ever lie. But more than that, whatever's on your brain should come out of your mouth.
Oh,
there
my.
Should be no filter. So this was a particularly trying.
Oh, nice. There's actually a real movement that suggests you do this?
Yes. It was founded by a psychologist in Virginia.
A psychologist who needs treatment, obviously, right?
He would argue everyone else in the world needs treatment but him. He was funny. He ran for Congress on an independent ticket.
Did he lose, we hope?
Yeah, he didn't quite make it. He said he was the only honest politician in history, was his pitch.
But in a marriage, to say everything that crosses your mind about your partner, I mean, because they're going to be positive things, they're going to be negative things.
I know. Yeah, it was The name of the article was, I think you're fat. So that gives you a sense of, I never said that to my wife, but that was the general feeling of what I had. I remember there was one point where we ran into a couple of my wife's old friends at a restaurant, and they she hadn't seen them in several years, and they said, oh, we should all get together. And I had to say, since the idea is no filter, I said, you seem like very nice people. But actually, I feel that I have enough friends who I don't get to see, so I'd rather not get together. And it was just an awkward, awkward moment.
I would think the biblical injunctions sound easier. Well, like getting back to the idea of the biblical injunction not to touch a woman during this time of month, is there a serious purpose to that?
Well, that's what I found was interesting, that even those injunctions that seem bizarre and absurd at the beginning, sometimes they would take on meaning by the end and really change my life for the better. There are people who argue that not touching women during certain times of the month has a very positive outcome. For me, that was not one that changed my life for the better. But for other people, they talk about how if you do that, it's like you appreciate what you have when you have it. So it's almost like you have honeymoon sex every month is what they say. So you don't appreciate what you have until you don't have it. So they say it's good to take
to
this
refrain,
break.
To refrain.
Right. Yeah, it's so, almost like the Sabbath, the same idea. You know, you've got to take a break to really understand what the goodness of what you have.
That one didn't work for you.
For me, that one did not. Yeah, not everything worked for me.
It wasn't honeymoon sex. It was sex from hell, right? When your wife was really mad.
Yeah, it was kind of stressful. That's right. I mean, I will say one of the interesting things I learned, I don't really talk about it in the book, but in biblical times, there were male impurity laws that you were not allowed to touch touch men after they had had sex, that they were considered impure for a day. And so there were times when I wouldn't shake men's hands, and they would ask why, and I would explain to them. And then that created also a bit of confusion and bafflement.
Now, how did you know that the men had sex?
I would say, you know, I don't know whether you have or not, so I...
you could be cautious.
To be on the safe side. And then a lot of my friends said, well, actually, I have a lot of friends with young kids, so I think a lot of them said, you have nothing to worry about. They were not having a lot of sex.
At that point. Well, we want to mention, we're going to take a break here and call us. We'll get right to you. A.J. Jacobs is with us. He's an editor for Esquire magazine. Once again, in paperback, his book is The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. A.J. is here in Columbus today, and he will be with us for the Thurber House Evenings with Authors. That's 7:30 this evening at the Columbus Performing Arts Center, 549 Franklin Avenue, and you can get tickets at the door, or you can call Thurber House if you'd like ticket information. Their number is 464-1032. That's 464-1032, and you should ask for or punch in extension 11. A.J. Jacobs is back with us and your phone calls after these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
The next Fresh Air, Bob Woodward talks about his fourth book chronicling the Bush administration titled The War Within, A Secret White House History 2006 to 2008. It's about dissension within the Bush administration and the military over strategy in Iraq, including the surge. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins later this afternoon. It starts at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 62 degrees at 10:30. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national source for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine Shodich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News. And you can discover more about WOSU Public Media online at WOSU.org. Hear the guests and topics from Open Line anytime when you podcast new and archived episodes and interviews. Listen when it's convenient or save your favorite shows. Podcast Open Line at WOSU.org. In the weather forecast for today, cloudy and rain off and on throughout the day. Maybe some sunshine later this afternoon, though, and a high of 72. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. With me here in the studio, A.J. Jacobs. He's an editor at Esquire magazine. He grew up in a very secular home where he says spirituality was almost a taboo subject. He was committed agnostic, but he decided out of a serious interest in religion and spirituality to embark on a year-long attempt to obey the dictates of the Bible literally. And his New York Times bestseller is in paperback. It's called The Year of Living Biblically. We're at 614-292-8513. Let's go to our callers. Jerome, hi, thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you for this opportunity. I've heard Mr. Jacobs interviewed a couple times, though I haven't read his book. I've enjoyed the conversation and learning how this journey has changed Mr. Jacobs, but I've got some concerns about this kind of journalism that I'd appreciate Mr. Jacobs addressing.
Okay.
I'm thinking back to, Herigel's Zen and the Art of Archery, and to me that is the most successful example of this kind of book, because he didn't set out to write a book. He went to Japan to teach for a few years, got talked into trying archery, it changed his life, and then he wrote a book about it. And there's other books like, Griffin's Black Like Me, which he did set out, but increasingly...
Yeah, he dyed his skin and with the pigment,
yeah.
And he set out to write a book. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, but still he's doing something different. And increasingly we're seeing books like Kim Dalby's Geisha, in which she goes and tries to be a geisha for a year.
So, Jerome, tell me your question here. What's your question?
Well, to me, it concerns me that what's happening is the subject is displacing the object of study. And it's about breaking new boundaries, and it's about a kind of tourism. What comes next? My year as a cannibal?
Jerome, hang on the line. AJ, what do you say?
Let me take down that idea. My year as a cannibal. I admit right up front, since the Bible says to be honest, that there are several motivations to embark on this journey. One of them was to try to understand religion. One of them was to explore fundamentalism. Because there are millions of Americans who say they take the Bible literally, and I wanted to see what if you actually do approach it from an extremely literal angle. And one of them, of course, was to write a book. So I'm totally upfront about that. And, I am a writer. That's what I do. And I love to explore topics that I find fascinating. And to me, religion is perhaps the most fascinating topic. And so how to explore it? What about a first-person journey? And so I think as long as you do it seriously and earnestly and you commit some time to it, I think the 24 hours of living biblically would be a little too flip. But if you I devoted a year of my life to this, and I really tried to learn about the Bible and different communities. So I'm actually a fan of the first person genre, the immersion journalism. As Black Like Me is a great book. George Plimpton, I don't know if you know him, but he wrote.
Yeah.
He would go and join a baseball team or
right.
a football team and write about the experience. So to me, there is something irreplaceable about a first-person experience, and as long as you go in with the right attitude, as long as you're not going in just to make a quick buck, or you're not passionate about the if it's a cynical ploy where you're not passionate about the topic, then the results can be a little bit flip. But I, as a whole, I think the genre, I'm a fan of it.
Jerome, mm-hmm. Quick one for you, then we got to move on.
I'm very suspicious of it. You know, it seems to be more reflective of a sign of our current culture. Like I said, the displacement of the subject of the object of inquiry by the subject's experience.
Okay, and Jerome, got to move on. Thanks for your call. Lots of people waiting. Let's go to Patricia. Hi, Patricia.
Oh, good. Good morning, gentlemen. And first of all, AJ, I absolutely love your work. I'm an Esquire subscriber.
Oh,
and
thank you.
I giggled so much about your story regarding tasting meat for the first time in 22 years. I couldn't even read the articles. I don't eat red meat. I was just... But before I get to my question, I have to tell you, I'm the lady from Columbus who always sends ideas to you. The one about the mama's boy, the hermaphrodite, I have the real neat writing.
Oh,
you
yeah.
never write back, but that's okay.
I read them, and I'm sorry, and I... Please forgive me. Have some Judeo-Christian forgiveness on my soul. I'm going to play the kid card. I have the three kids, so I don't have enough time to respond to everyone. I'm sorry.
At least you remembered. Okay. Regarding food habits, how did those change during your time of living biblically? Because they didn't have Cheetos or espresso, so what did you eat? You couldn't have survived on figs and almonds. Come on.
I did. You're right. I did try to eat as biblically as possible. Almonds, figs, grapes were big. Hummus, they had some of that. It was almost like the Mediterranean diet.
Okay.
It was interesting because the Bible has, in the Old Testament at least, there are some very strict rules about what you can and cannot eat. The Bible says that you cannot eat pork, you cannot eat shellfish, mm-hmm. no hawks or eagles or vultures. So I had to get rid of those completely, which was a huge imposition. Yeah. It also says, interestingly, no bugs with the exception of crickets, grasshoppers, and locusts, which I thought was I felt I had to almost take advantage of that loophole. So I did actually try a cricket, a chocolate-covered one, which maybe they did not eat in Moses' time. But it was also interesting to obey these laws, which are similar to the laws of the kosher eaters.
Exactly.
I didn't go quite as they go beyond the biblical laws, but I stuck with just the biblical ones. And it was interesting because this was one of the ones that I think Fred and I had talked about a little, where they seemed absurd on the face of it, but by the end of the year, they really had taken on some meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the meaning was that you are very aware of what you're eating, and eating becomes a conscious and almost spiritual act, as opposed to just shoving food in. I would pay more attention to my part in the cycle of food and the cycle of life, and be more aware of where it was grown and how it came to me, and be more thankful. I mean, in the end, it made me more thankful for the food that I do have.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, I mean, living in the greatest food city on earth, not to mention the bars, Fairway Market. Oh, my goodness.
Thank you, Patricia. Appreciate your call.
Thank
with
you
AJ
so much.
Jacobs.
Have fun in Columbus.
And thanks for the emails.
Okay, bye-bye.
614-292-8513. Open line at WOSU.org for emails. Well, also there were in addition to injunctions about what eat or not to eat or what to wear or not to wear, there were qualities of character that you were, for example, now prayer was something you had not been familiar with terribly, right? And
yes,
in your home,
prayer was a huge challenge because I never in my life prayed before. As I say in the book, I never said the word. I rarely said the word Lord without following it by of the rings. So here I was for the first time praying. And in the very beginning, I was It was very uncomfortable. I remember literally sweating. My palms and my forehead would get sweaty.
Uncomfortable because?
For two reasons. One was that I felt I was I might be taking the Lord's name in vain if I'm not believing in the Lord. Should I be praying to God? And the second is that as an agnostic, I thought maybe I'm violating some agnostic's creed where you're not supposed to pray to God. So it was odd in the beginning, but the more I forced myself to do it every day, and by the end, it really did take on some meaning for me. As I mentioned, the prayers of thanksgiving, that I found to be wonderful and enlightening. Also, prayers about other people, praying for those people who are sick, or friends who are in need. And I don't, as someone who had a secular and scientific mindset for over 35 years, I found it hard to accept the fact that praying for my friend with cancer would actually get rid of the cancer. I still have trouble believing that. But I think that it's good in other ways. It's beneficial because praying for other people makes you think of other people, makes you more compassionate. Mm. It makes you get outside of your own mind and your own petty worries. Here are 10 minutes a day. I can't be thinking about my Amazon sales ranking or
right.
my little career worries. You know, here are 10 minutes a day. I'm thinking about other people, and it hopefully makes me a more tolerant and compassionate person.
Now, with the year of living biblically over, do you still pray?
I do pray. I don't know whether you would call it prayer or meditation or giving thanks because, you know, I am this reverent agnostic. But I do find it important to take time out every day to acknowledge what we have and also acknowledge how lucky I am and to think of other people, force myself to think of other people who are not as fortunate and what I can do for them.
Do you, are there other personal qualities? You say this helped you develop compassion, really. It's almost an exercise in compassion praying, right? Were there other personal qualities that the Bible enjoined you to cultivate, and did you?
Well, one of them was, I talk about how the Bible says no coveting, no gossiping, and I live in New York City, and I work in the media, so this is a huge part of my day, 65-70% of my day. So, I mean, that was an incredible challenge. I will say the gossiping, it seems like a small thing, but when you force yourself not to gossip, I never fully, by the way, eliminated gossip from my life, but I was able to bring it down, to contract it and limit it. And it turned out to be one of the more profound and life-changing parts of my year.
But by the way, when you say gossip, AJ, what do you mean? How do you define gossip? Saying something negative about another person or just saying something about another person?
Well, it depends on how you interpret it. I went with saying something negative mm-hmm. about a person, mm-hmm. whether it's Britney Spears or a friend of mine or a relative. And as opposed to saying it to their face as constructive criticism. So the odd thing to me was that I would force myself not to say negative things. And eventually it started to affect the way I thought and the way I perceived people because my brain started to generate fewer negative thoughts. I became less cynical about humans. I think that it might have had something to do with the fact that my brain is lazy and my mind would start to generate a negative idea and then say to itself, well, you know, this is never going to make it out into the atmosphere,
into the world, yeah.
So why even bother? And then I became a much more positive outlook. That was one of the big lessons of the year, was how much the behavior affects our thinking, how much the outer affects the inner. I had always believed beforehand, you change your thinking and then you change your behavior. But often it's the other way around. You force yourself to act like a better person, almost pretend to be a better person, and eventually you become a little bit of a better person. There was a great quote by Charles Van Doren the poet, that said, he said, if you want to be a knight, K-N-I-G-H-T, if you want to be a knight, act like a knight. And I think that there's some wisdom in that.
Wow. Yeah, because you do hear the other way around. Change your thinking, you'll change your actions. You don't hear the reverse, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, it is. They do talk about it in cognitive and behavioral psychology. So it is gaining credibility in psychological circles. And there are even, even the small things, like you force yourself to smile, and it sort of tricks the brain into believing you're a happier person. So actually smiling makes you happier.
A.J. Jacobs with us this hour, editor, one of the editors at Esquire magazine. His current book is now in paperback, The Year of Living Biblically. It's subtitled One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. And A.J. is in Columbus for the Thurber House Evenings with Authors event. It's tonight at 7:30 at the Columbus Performing Arts Center. That's at 549 Franklin Avenue. You can show up and get a ticket at the door, or you can call Thurber House for ticket information, 464-1032. That's 464-1032, extension 11. And for us now, if you'd like to talk to AJ now, 614-292-8513. Emails to openline at wosu.org. Well, you actually phoned up someone who is a Jehovah's Witness and asked them to come to your home.
Yes, that was I wanted to, throughout the year, not just go on my own spiritual journey, but also to experience as many other religious interpretations of the Bible as possible. So I spent a lot of time with Hasidic Jews and evangelical Christians. I visited the Amish. And as you say, I had a Jehovah's Witness come to my home. And I think that I might be the only person in America to actually out Bible talk a Jehovah's Witness. He came over to my house, and after 3.5 hours, he looked at his watch and he said, I got to go. I can't take this anymore. But I was just so fascinated with the topic and the way he interpreted the Bible.
And you also did he come back? Did you have further conversation or just?
He actually, I would have welcomed him back, but I think I scared him off.
How about now? Also, you visited an Amish community. And by the way, there's a great Amish joke they told you, right?
Oh yes. Well, it was interesting because every community I visited, that my preconceived notions, my stereotypes, were smashed to bits. And this Amish man that I stayed with, he actually turned out to be sort of a Amish. A stand-up comedian, an Amish version
like
of
a Henny Youngman, but Amish.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I want to manage your expectations. The joke is not necessarily the funniest joke you'll ever hear, but he was working with a lot of constraints as an Amish person. So he said, what happened when the Amish woman married the Mennonite man? And Mennonites are like Amish, but a little less strict. Mm-hmm. And the punchline is she drove him buggy, as in the buggies that they use instead of cars. So
if you'd been practicing radical honesty that day, would you have laughed?
It might have been a strain. But it was fascinating to visit him and see how he lived. And I remember I was so moved by a couple of the things I saw. I watched an Amish baseball game, which I didn't expect to see, but it was a really almost a beautiful baseball game because it was silent. It was there was no trash talking because they don't believe in insults and gossip. So it was a silent and almost transcendent baseball game. One of the most beautiful baseball games I've ever seen.
What else did you learn about your spiritual nature from Amish people?
I learned, the beauty of silence. I remember learning about I learned that religion evolves, and even those groups that try not to evolve, they do evolve, and the Amish are an example of this, where in a sense they wear clothes from the 17th century, and they follow biblical injunctions that are 3,000 years old. That they don't shave their beard. That's why they have a beard. Mm-hmm. They refuse to take photographs or be in photographs because that would violate the second commandment, which says that you shall not make images. So they take that literally and don't make any images. So in a sense, they have they have stopped time. But in other senses, not at all. You know, they have found various loopholes and ways around it so that they can adapt and participate in our in the 21st century. Rollerblades are allowed. Cars are not, but rollerblades are. Or baseball, they play baseball. They have some of them they instead of using electricity, electricity is banned, but they can use gas power or solar power. So it's interesting to see the ways that, that people adjust.
What did you learn from the Jehovah's Witness in that 3.5-hour conversation?
Oh, well, I learned it was all about smashing my stereotypes. They do take the Bible extremely literally in some ways. In other ways, they have what seems to be a strangely progressive view of religion. I remember them talking about the concept of hell, and they do not believe in the concept of hell because they believe that that no just and loving God would condemn his children to hell, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah. You visited the late Reverend Jerry Falwell's church, is that right?
Yes, that's true. That's true. I went to I felt that I wanted to see evangelical Christianity in all its forms. So I did spend a lot of time with progressive evangelicals who were amazing and inspiring people. I also wanted to see more conservative, the more traditional evangelical Christianity, like Reverend Falwell. And that was interesting because it was surprising. It was almost a split personality, because in some senses they were very intolerant. You know, they're intolerant of homosexuality. And that I disagree with very strongly. At the same time, they were some of the friendliest, most genuine, kindest, open-hearted people I'd ever met. Hmm. So it was almost like this sweet and sour at the same time. And it was interesting to experience.
Early in the show, you mentioned the biblical injunction to stone the adulterer.
Right, yes.
What does the Bible actually say about that?
Well, the Bible has a tremendous amount of capital punishment in the Old Testament, and I felt I had to do something about stoning because it's in there, stone. So I was able to stone one adulterer. I was in the park in New York City, and I was dressed at that point in my most biblical garb, where I was wearing the robe and the sandals. And a man came up to me and said, why are you dressed like that? And I explained, I'm trying to follow everything in the Bible, from the Ten Commandments right on down to stoning adulterers. And he says to me, well, I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me? And I said, well, yes, that would be terrific. And I took out...
We got a contract agreement.
I said, I've been waiting for this moment. I took out a handful of stones that I had been carrying around for this. They were small stones. That was sort of my loophole, my way of obeying the letter of the law.
But you've been carrying them around, waiting for the opportunity.
That's right, because I had been hoping. I wanted to check this off my list. He actually grabbed the stones out of my hand and threw them at me. So it was almost an eye for an eye. I felt I could throw one back at him, and that was the way I stoned. And it did. It was an odd experience, but it did allow me to explore in a serious way the idea of capital punishment in the Bible, and how can the Bible be so compassionate and wise and merciful in some parts, and yet have these really strict, tough laws about capital punishment in others.
What did you conclude about that?
Well, I concluded many things. You know, it's an incredibly complicated topic. One of the things I concluded was that that we cannot follow everything in the Bible. You know, fundamentalists say that you have to follow everything in the Bible, and they call it, when you only follow parts, they call it cafeteria religion. And that's a disparaging phrase. You're just picking and choosing parts of the Bible. But to me, there's nothing wrong with cafeterias. I've had some delicious meals at cafeterias. If you choose the right foods, it's a very nourishing, wonderful meal. So to me, choosing the parts of the Bible about compassion, about loving your neighbor, about gratefulness, this is wonderful. And as opposed to focusing on the parts about intolerance or hatred or misogyny or laws against homosexuality, which are also in the Bible. If you're going to be honest, they are there. So it's all about focusing on the right parts.
AJ, when you began the year of living biblically, you said you had a suspicion that people who said they followed the Bible literally picked and choosed, that they did as well, just like you do. Did you find that to be true?
I did find that to be true. I mean, it's a complicated topic because Christians believe that Jesus' death nullified many, if not most, of the laws in the Old Testament, but not all of them. You know, there are moral laws, they say, that continue, like the laws against homosexuality. Some fundamentalists say that is an eternal law and that was not nullified. To me, there is picking and choosing, because even if you take everything literally, there's passages in the New Testament that say women should not speak at church. So if you took it really literally, you would have churches where there are no women in the choir, mm-hmm. where women have to be silent as soon as they enter the doors of the church. So I think everyone picks and chooses, and it's okay. I think it's okay as long as we pick and choose the parts mm-hmm. that I think are compassionate.
Getting back to character issues, you say one of the things you had to do during the course of the year, you had to battle anger. Is that right?
Oh, yes. I mean, once you start to pay attention to your sins, you can't believe how much we do. You know, it's just shocking how much we lie, covet, gossip, and are angry. And the Bible says, be slow to anger. That's one of the Proverbs. And so I really had to try to do that again. Very difficult. The way I try, the most successful method I found was to focus on those things that I had and be grateful for them, as opposed to. So, you know, I would go to the ATM, the bank machine, and they would charge me $1.75 for taking it out, and that would make me so angry. But then I would focus on the fact, well, at least I have some money to take out of the bank machine, so I should be grateful for that. So, you know, a huge challenge.
Another, just we have a couple of minutes left here, and I wanted to get back to this idea of changing behavior and that changing thinking. When you cease gossiping, your brain gets less interested in thinking gossipy negative thoughts about other people. Were there other kinds of behavior, the outward behavior, that you changed and therefore changed the way you thought?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think my whole year was like that. I think that coveting, once you stop. I think if you stop flipping through magazines and looking at all of the, you know, fancy gadgets and fancy cars that you could have, you stop coveting as much. So you change your behavior and you almost shape your environment a little, and it'll change the way you think.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any in the final minute? Do you have any? You say, you know, you're a reverent atheist. You continue to pray,
right?
Are you going to have any future spiritual explorations in mind? I mean, is there anything that Christian? Oh, yeah, I'd really like to check this out a little further?
Absolutely. I continue to learn. And actually, after the year, my wife and I did join a synagogue in our neighborhood. And it's a Reform synagogue, and we don't really go very often. But at least we joined. And because I want to give my sons a little taste of religion, whether or not they become religious or stay or become atheists, I don't care, as long as they're good people. But I thought it would be nice to give them a taste of their heritage.
Sure. Well, my guest, A.J. Jacobs, an editor for Esquire magazine. His current book is now in paperback, The Year of Living Biblically. And, of course, it's subtitled One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. A.J. is here in Columbus for the Thurber House Evenings with Authors series. You can meet him and see him tonight at 7:30 at the Columbus Performing Arts Center, 549 Franklin Avenue. And tickets are available at the door, or you can call Thurber House at 464-1032. That's 464-1032. A.J., a pleasure. Pleasure reading your book. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me, Fred.
When we come back, Adid Dawisha and Karen Dawisha, a political scientist from Miami University, challenges for U.S. foreign policy from Iraq to the Middle East to Russia on listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.